gust as high as 25 miles per hour, expecting a high of 65, which is right at the normal point for this time of year. Mostly cloudy tonight, a low of 40. Things get a lot colder tomorrow, mostly sunny but chilly, a high of 52. The five-day weather trend, frosty conditions tomorrow night, followed by a slow warming trend by Tuesday. We should be back into the upper 60s, dry through the period. Right now, 57. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. Before we get to today's morning show, we want to remind you that the morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock, and the program is archived on our website, wgtd.org. You're also invited to subscribe to the podcast version of the morning show in order to enjoy a different morning show 7 days a week. To subscribe, look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. It's available on all of the major podcast platform providers, including Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, and Spotify. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today we tackle a very important and unhappy topic, Alzheimer's disease. So many of us in one way or another have been impacted by Alzheimer's disease as it has affected someone in our lives whom we care about or love. On Wednesday, October 12th, an expert on Alzheimer's, in fact, one of the country's leading experts on Alzheimer's, will be visiting the campus of the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. His name, Dr. Jason Karlowish, who teaches medicine and medical ethics at the University of Pennsylvania and serves as co-director of the Penn Memory Center. His presentation will be based, at least in large measure, on a book he has written called The Problem of Alzheimer's: How Science, Culture, and Politics Turned a Rare Disease into a Crisis and What We Can Do About It. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. Dr. Jason Karlowish, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm really glad we can have this conversation. I wish we could be talking about a more pleasant topic. Alzheimer's, of course, is just about as bad as it gets in terms of the kind of devastation that it causes. Ahead of us digging into some specifics, I'd be really curious to know a little bit about your own background in terms of what initially drew you to this particular branch of medicine or to this particular specialty?
Yeah, you know, all disease is unpleasant. If a thing called disease was pleasant, I don't know why we would call it a disease. But I agree with you, there's something uniquely unpleasant or disturbing, I think might be the better word, about Alzheimer's disease. Because at the heart of what's disturbing, of course, is that people develop disabling cognitive impairments. And that's what got me interested in it through a broader set of interests in not just medicine, because, of course, I trained to be a physician, but also interests in ethics, policy, and culture. Because of all the diseases that affect humans, diseases that cause dementia, that cause brain cells to slowly dysfunction, die, and lead to disability from that are particularly fascinating because, and in this sense, and I talk about this in the book, Alzheimer's is a distinctly modern disease because it really fundamentally is a disease of autonomy. It takes away our ability to self-determine our lives, to exercise our identity. And again, you know, as someone whose interests weren't simply were certainly science, you know, as reified through medicine, but also ethics and culture, I just early on found the disease quite interesting, and that was 20-some-odd years ago, and I'm still working in the space of it, yeah.
If you'll permit me a somewhat personal question, I'm just curious. I kind of made somewhat blithe reference in my introduction to the fact that almost all of us have somebody in our lives who has been affected by Alzheimer's. And I'm just curious if that is also true of you, or if by and large your direct encounter with Alzheimer's is more of a professional thing.
Well, both, obviously, professionally, but also, yes, personally. In fact, to round out my autobiography, so I gave you a very academic answer, you know, about my intellectual interests that made this disease so fascinating. But you know, personally, early in my career, actually, after I finished training in internal medicine, I was going to become a pulmonary critical care physician. I was in a fellowship training program at the University of Chicago, and I was also interested in aging. And anyway, to make a sad story short, around that time, it was clear that my grandfather was suffering disabling cognitive impairments. And, you know, he had this sort of sloppy diagnosis, really non-diagnosis, et cetera. And was kind of cared for by a daughter who just filled in naturally without any real guidance and whatnot. Anyway, he falls, breaks his hip, goes to a major academic medical center, and 6 months later he's dead. And I realized, you know, the drama that ensued from that point forward of his fall and death, and even the events prior, really showed me, you know, critical care is important, and by God, the last 2 years have shown us that in awful, dramatic ways how important critical care is. But it was clear also that you know, improving the diagnosis, treatment, and care of older adults with dementia caused by diseases like Alzheimer's or Lewy body disease, that this was a huge need. And I think things are of equal importance, critical illness, dementia, but there's a greater need. You almost feel it's kind of a ethical obligation to take on the thing that has the greater, if you will, need, because there's just so few people in the field. So I dropped out of critical care. Probably the first and only person to do that, to switch to geriatric medicine and pursued it since. And then also on a personal note, my father has mild stage right now of dementia caused likely by Alzheimer's. And I've been dealing now, being sort of the caregiver at a distance for him. So I have now direct narrative, personal narrative experience twice over.
Wow, I am sorry for you, and I'm sorry for everybody who has people in their lives, you know, for which that's the case. But
the work caring for my father has been very interesting because, you know, he lives at a distance, and it sort of taught me in great empathetic detail what it means to be a caregiver and the various roles of a caregiver and how one has to make decisions about which of those roles you're going to take on. And if you're not going to take those roles on, who's going to take them on? And so it's really kind of transformed my understanding of caregiving above and beyond my professional understanding of it. And so, you know, I wouldn't wish the role on anyone, you know, but again, you know, we're all either going to be caregivers or need caregivers someday. So I'm sort of glad I'm having this experience.
Of course. And it's interesting, too, to hear you use the term critical care in a couple of different ways. I mean, having left the field that we call critical care because you see such a critical need when it comes to dealing with this particular population and those who are afflicted by Alzheimer's and things like it.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, we have had, the United States of America, has had about 40 years to get our act in gear to take on the problem of Alzheimer's disease and repeatedly just missed the opportunities. And so the result is we're in this kind of deeply difficult situation now where we've made bits of spectacular progress, but at the same time, just lack of progress. So, you know, we're almost like some weird organism that has like an incredible brain but lacks feet, or pick your metaphor, if you will, because what we have is the ability to diagnose the disease using biomarkers, and we're on the edge potentially of not treating the disease with anti-amyloid drugs, but we have absolutely really no functional workforce out there to diagnose the disease, prescribe, and treat. And we had 40 years to do that, but we just never could seem to solve that as a country.
Hmm. Before we dig into that just a little deeper, I would love to hear just a little bit about the Penn Memory Center, of which I believe you serve as co-director, and I imagine that it is in your work there at Penn Memory Center that you continue to learn a great deal about this disease. Tell us what the Penn Memory Center offers to those who are housed there, and what kind of a role that has played in your ongoing work.
Yeah, the Penn Memory Center certainly is a character in the book, and many of the patients, in fact, most of the patients that I discussed in the book and their family members come from my experiences as a clinician at the Penn Memory Center. It's a multidisciplinary outpatient clinical practice based at the University of Pennsylvania, where we diagnose and treat older adults with cognitive impairments, typically caused by diseases like Alzheimer's and Lewy body disease, frontotemporal lobar degeneration, vascular disease. We also have a very rigorous research program to discover better diagnostics, therapeutics, and modes of delivering care. What's unique about the center is that it's unique. In most memory centers that do what we do are based at academic institutions, typically heavily cross-subsidized through research funds and also philanthropy. I point this out in the book, that the tragic, and I've sort of already gestured to this, but the tragedy of this disease is if you just set up a clinical practice devoted to the diagnosis and treatment of older adults with cognitive impairment and said, I'll let the insurance system of the healthcare system of America, you know, support it, you'd probably close down in about 2 months because you wouldn't be able to make your salaries because the revenue streams are so poor. Our center, we're very proud of it. There's myself, a geriatrician. There are neurologists, psychiatry, psychologists who do cognitive testing. We have a vigorous social work program that provides education, training, and support to patients and families. And we also have a very successful communications team to educate our patients, the region, and frankly, the nation. If people want to learn more about the Memory Center, I'd invite you just go Google, I guess, Penn Memory Center, P-E-N-N, Memory Center, and you'll find us. You can sign up for our we have a weekly news magazine that comes out via email, and you can sign up and be a subscriber to that.
Mm. For those of you just joining us, I am speaking today on The Morning Show with Dr. Jason Karlowish, Professor of Medicine and Medical Ethics at the University of Pennsylvania and co-director of the Penn Memory Center, also author of a book called The Problem with Alzheimer's. Dr. Karlowish is going to be coming to the campus of the University of Wisconsin Parkside next Wednesday, October 12th, and we're honored to have him on The Morning Show today. Dr. Karlowish, I made reference in the introduction to the fact that probably today versus 20 years ago, we don't have to take a whole lot of time to talk about, in a sense, what Alzheimer's disease is, or certainly the kind of havoc that it tends to cause in people's lives. I do think, however, it would be interesting and helpful for what we're going to be exploring to get a little bit of a historical long view in terms of when medical science first began to recognize this disability, which we now call Alzheimer's. Explain the background of that.
Yeah, the story actually goes back to the early 20th century, 1905, 6, 7, 8, 9. In those over 100 years ago, medical science was making pretty impressive progress with understanding, uncovering the mysteries, because what they were doing was saying, there's something about these older adults who we think have senility, an extreme stage of aging for which there's nothing you can do about it and no disease involved, and saying, well, it doesn't seem to be the case. And I sort of enjoyed and chronicled this in the book, The Problem of Alzheimer's, how these scientists were making spectacular progress. And then it all stopped, and it all stopped because it was taking place in Germany. And, you know, I mentioned those years deliberately because I think anyone who's familiar with world history, particularly European history, will know that after about 1914, things got really bad in Germany. And I talk about that and the aftermath of it, which kind of led to a dark ages, quite literally, for much of the 20th century until the story picks up again, but this time across the Atlantic Ocean in the United States of America. And so, you know, that's why the subtitle of the book is How Science, Culture, and Politics Turned a Rare Disease into a Crisis, because it is really a story much more than just simply there are a lot of old people, which is one of the reasons why there are a lot of people with Alzheimer's. But the reason why this disease went from being rare to a crisis are because of these cultural and political events that I talk about. And they begin, as I say, in the early 20th century, and it's very much about a story of Germany in the early 20th century.
Right. So I think what you're saying is it was not because of any specific reason or for any purpose that attention was diverted from this. It was just due to the chaos that engulfed Germany and so much of Europe with the First World War and events after that, and then the Second World War. I mean, that in a sense, all kinds of things, including this, were shoved to the side. I mean, is that a sense, the essence of it?
I mean, because what happened in Germany was that was where the progress was being made in some very elegant neuropathology work using light microscopy, you know, as opposed to electron microscopy. And they were really beginning to make some great progress, but then, you know, it wasn't just the war and the economic problems. It was also the political and cultural transformations in Germany, namely the rise of eugenics and euthanasia theories, as instantiated, of course, through the National Socialist ideology of the Nazis, that all worked together, not just simply to, you know, create economic chaos to limit the ability to do the research, but also created a cultural milieu that really sank progress in psychiatric neuropathologic approaches to these diseases, and instead embraced this kind of dark eugenic view, and it ruined the science, it ruined the reputations of the scientists, et cetera. And then, of course, what happened was biologic psychiatry, as it was being practiced then, faded away, and Freudianism took over. And there's an interesting story about how Freudianism went from being this fringe approach to thinking about mental illness, brain illness, to being a dominant approach. And of course, America was ground zero of Freudian practice in psychiatry, which of course is amusing because Freud hated America. He was a bit of a snob. And of course, it's amusing that, of course, America just embraced Freudianism. And so it crowded out thinking about diseases of the brain as being caused by any kind of biology, but rather, you know, instead embraced a Freudian idea of, you know, suppressed psychopathologies.
Wow. So there are these forces that, in effect, are diverting attention, suppressing study, and that really is tragic when one thinks about promising breakthroughs so early on that came to nothing because of that.
If World War One hadn't happened, and the work of Alois Alzheimer's, Oscar Fischer, Puccini, and others was allowed to continue apace, it's quite possible by 1960 that there would have been this recognition that older adults who were being sort of dismissed as senile, you know, extreme aging, nothing you can do about it, that would have been, no, there's a disease going on here. And it really raises interesting possibilities about where we'd be now. And I think it would have a lot of influence on improving our overall well-being, because we would have earlier on seen that, you know, these older adults who were losing their ability to self-determine their lives, family members being swept up in kind of a maelstrom of all kinds of problems, you know, that we really need to support them and support the autonomy of these older adults and their children, adult children, spouses, et cetera. But none of that happened, and I think it's one of the reasons why, you know, frankly, anti-liberal attitudes sort of, you know, linger and still linger, because, you know, if you see things like losing your ability to live your life the way you want to as just part of nature, you know, you just think, well, there's nothing we can do about it, and et cetera. And we could have made much more progress, but that didn't happen.
Hmm. My understanding is that that there was something of a scientific reawakening, or maybe an awakening for the first time in certain places, to the significance of Alzheimer's. Ahead of us talking about that, early on, as you said, it's Dr. Alois Alzheimer in Germany who first puts a name to this disorder. At that point in time, would any medical doctors in the United States of America, for instance, have heard of Alzheimer's? Was it known at all?
Absolutely not. It was in. It was not. Absolutely not. The disease was put into one of the editions in the late 19-teens of Emil Kreplin's psychiatry textbook. He mentions Alzheimer's disease as a cause of the senile dementias, notably, by the way, not the early onset. If you read the book, that point will certainly shock you. So it was in his textbook, but it never caught hold, in part because Kreplin's textbook faded from existence, because Kreplin got swept up in Nazism, and his textbook became just not read. And so in America, the idea of diagnosing Alzheimer's disease was just, it would just, you wouldn't, the physician would at least say, what are you talking about? I don't even know what that is. And I think it's a very important point, actually, because by about the late 19-teens, even into the 1920s, in Munich, if you, a historian, Lara Koik, of historian of medicine, currently working out of Berlin, she's gone through the archives of the Munich hospital, and the physicians there were actually diagnosing Alzheimer's disease. If you go to the medical records, you see them recording, you know, Alzheimer's disease as the cause of someone's dementia, and both young and old people, that is to say people in their 50s and people in their 70s or 80s. And so they were using this diagnosis. Of course, that all sort of faded as well, because, again, yeah, things really just after about the 1920s fell apart in Germany.
We're speaking with Dr. Jason Karlowish, professor of medicine and medical ethics at the University of Pennsylvania, and the author of a book called The Problem with Alzheimer's. That is also the title of a presentation he'll be giving at the University of Wisconsin Parkside next Wednesday, October 12th. So, Dr. Karlowish, help us understand what happens in the 1970s. What causes sort of an awakening of sorts in terms of Alzheimer's and its significance?
A neurologist named Robert Katzman, who's kind of down on his career, but has got a lot of ambition, a lot of smarts, suddenly says, this is a big problem, and I'm going to take it on. He had devoted himself to Parkinson's disease, and he thought he was going to discover ways that he could cause nerve cells to regenerate. And that research couldn't get funded. And so he's kind of bereft of a focus for his work. And now this is when things get personal. His mother-in-law develops dementia, and, of course, the family witnesses in full-scale personal intensity how awful the system is in America for diagnosis and treatment. And so he puts all, you know, he's got an open mind. He sees that this problem is big, and he essentially kind of picks up where Alois Alzheimer's left off. Now, he's not alone in this. In fact, he's kind of looking at the work of other people and saying, all these older adults with senility that doctors just shrug their shoulders and say it's just aging, there's nothing we can do about it. I think that they have this disease called Alzheimer's disease, you know, which was thought to be a rare disease only seen in younger people, people under the age of 65, 60. And he writes a short 1,200-word essay that essentially argues, you know, the rare thing called Alzheimer's and the very common thing called senility are actually the same thing, and we should call it Alzheimer's disease. And it's a short essay, 1,200 words, quotes some science and leaves it at that. But he then devotes himself to sort of becoming almost a sort of scientific activist. And he would be one of the instigators to create the organization that would come to be known as the Alzheimer's Association. And he would really be an advocate to move the NIA to make it their focus to fund research in Alzheimer's. He would lead one of the earlier centers in the field as well. And it was his work that really kind of jump-started things. Of course, the other event, of course, is the public. So the people like him, who are doctors, namely a bunch of, across the United States, independent organizations start popping up of family members who are just sort of fed up with the system. As only in America, if you try to get help and you can't find a system to help you, you form a self-help group, right? You know, and all these, there were seven independent self-help groups formed in America with some sort of focus on dementia, Alzheimer's, et cetera. Anyway, the key actor there is a very wealthy industrialist from Chicago named Jerry Stone of the Stone Container Corporation, whose wife had dementia. And like many wealthy, hard-driving American executive types, he wasn't going to take no for an answer. Anyway, long story short, Jerry Stone basically kind of takes on the George Washington role and brings all these groups together to try and form a common organization, which he does succeed in doing, namely the organization that would come to be called the Alzheimer's Association. And all these events unfold in a fairly narrow period of time. They get from about 1976 to about 1983, really, is when all this happens. Hmm. And it really lays the groundwork for what we have today, which is, you know, the NIA is the leading funding agency for Alzheimer's research, and the Alzheimer's Association is one of the leading advocates to advance improvements in diagnosis, treatment, and care for people with Alzheimer's.
If I understand correctly, one problem which thwarts what might have been even more forceful progress in the 1980s is the divided U.S. Congress during the presidency of Ronald Reagan. Quantify for us, if you can, or help us understand at least the significance of that and why partisan politics would intrude on a matter in which it seems like people should fairly easily come to some accord.
Yeah, so Ronald Reagan looms large in the book as kind of a very interesting character. Of course, you know, Reagan himself ultimately would tell America that he had Alzheimer's disease and that's what he would die of. I don't think if you had asked Reagan during his 8 years in office, you know, are you opposed to improving care and treatment for people with Alzheimer's, that he would have said anything other than no, or, you know, or he would have said, I am very much in favor of that. Having said that, the Reagan era, Reaganism, introduced a series of political ideologies, perspectives that were antithetical to advancing the mission of the Alzheimer's Association. So the Alzheimer's Association's mission was, improve services and supports and care for people living with this disease, which of course meant long-term care services and supports, because you're talking about a disease which for a period of years, 6, 8, 10 years, people need long-term care services and supports because they're disabled and getting progressively more disabled. Reagan came into office in the 1980, absolutely, completely transparent. My goal is to shrink the size of the federal government, cut taxes. He, in particular, called out Medicare and Medicaid as sources of waste and corruption and felt that budgets were bloated. So he had zero political appetite to take on the role of expanding Medicare to provide long-term care services and supports. It was a non-starter. And that perspective, together with a family values perspective that argued that the state's involvement in family matters in some way would corrupt or otherwise harm the family, would also thwart creating long-term care services supports, because the sort of standard default was, well, you know, this is what families do, right? You know, and particularly what that meant was women. And so if you combine those two ideological perspectives together, you essentially have a no-go for making any substantial progress to form a system of long-term care services and supports for the American family that struggles on their own to care for someone with progressive disabling cognitive problems. And that ethos still exists today. I think you just essentially don't see much conversation on a bipartisan basis about this. It was a non-topic, for example, when the last president, the president prior to Biden, was running for re-election. There was no discussion from his platform about long-term care services and supports. Hmm.
When it comes to actually research into Alzheimer's and understanding it, I know that one of the breakthroughs that has occurred is being able to diagnose it while someone is still alive and suffering from it. That once upon a time, the only way to conclusively know that someone had Alzheimer's was after they had died, and then to examine their brain and find if it was riddled with the plaques and tangles that are an indication of Alzheimer's, and and which I assume actually caused the damage we're talking about. At what point did it become possible to diagnose Alzheimer's in a different way?
Yeah, you're right. Up until up until July 2002, Alzheimer's was a ghoulish story, because the only way I could tell you definitively what's causing you to have dementia is if you die and I autopsy your brain. But of course, you're dead. You'll never know. So it was utterly ghoulish. And in July of 2002, in Stockholm, Sweden, at the International Alzheimer's meetings, the first images of the brain of a person with dementia thought caused by Alzheimer's, the first images of that brain's measure of amyloid was shown. And so that was the premiere of the Pittsburgh Compound B, which was a radio tracer that is injected into your vein, and then you lie on a scanner, and the scanner can detect whether that tracer is attached to amyloid in your brain. And so that was the beginning of the biomarker revolution, where we could now see the pathology in the brain of a living human, the pathology of amyloid. And we've got another 10 or 12 years for that same method to be able to see tau, the other pathology. And so in about a 20-year span, we transformed from saying, only until you die can I tell you really what the definitive pathology is, to I can see these pathologies in your living brain. And I was able to interview those researchers. It's a fascinating story about how the work they did to move from a provocative, almost fringy idea to an idea that was revolutionary, you know, transformed the way we think about and soon diagnose the disease.
And what difference does it make in terms of being able to diagnose in that fashion, apart from the most obvious, which is someone potentially can be told, or we know about this person who is alive, you have Alzheimer's. But I assume that beyond that, there is value in being able to diagnose Alzheimer's in this way, in terms of just the furthering of the field, the furthering of progress in terms of understanding the disease better.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, to speak to a matter that's quite relevant to patients and families is it's a very valuable means to test potential treatments, because you can now say definitively that whether or not a person has the pathology, and test out drugs that you think may alter the disease course, and even then measure over time how is the pathology responding, in addition to measuring things like daily function and cognition. So it allows you to have to develop treatments that potentially can slow the disease. And we're beginning to see the fruits of that effort as recently as last week or so, or 2 weeks ago, when the results of a clinical trial of a drug targeting amyloid were released that suggests the drug slows the progression of the disease. It also allows the disease to be diagnosed at a stage before you're clearly disabled, at a stage when you have, you know, cognitive problems that are causing inefficiencies in your daily life, commonly called mild cognitive impairment. And it allows you to say whether that mild cognitive impairment is caused by, you know, is an earliest sign of Alzheimer's disease versus some other disease. And I think, you know, there's a certain, I think, logic to wanting to get the disease diagnosed early and treated, because, you know, why should we, you know, just much like cancer, we'd like to catch it before it's widely metastatic. I think the same logic applies here. You know, there's certainly obviously challenges in terms of, the, you know, of ethics and policy to be addressed, but I'd rather have to deal with those challenges than the alternative, which is none.
Right. And of course, now at this point, although by no means do we have a cure for Alzheimer's, there are treatments which seem to have some effect on the most debilitating effects.
We've had effective treatments for this disease probably for about 30 years. Namely, there's good evidence that if you provide the person with the disease and their family education, training, and support, and access to key services, that you can improve the well-being of the person with the disease and their family members And don't underestimate this. Oh, come on, Jason. You know, that's just like, you know, social service stuff, you know. Don't underestimate that the importance of treating a mind well to allow that mind to flourish. And ask any parent who's raised a developing mind, you know, the consequences of a disorganized environment, disrupted social interactions on the quality and well-being of that child's brain. And the same thing applies at the other end of life. Unfortunately, again, this gets back to the points I was talking about earlier, you know, we just haven't as a society felt that that was a social priority. We just sort of devolve it back to families and say, well, you all just figure it out on your own, you know, which I just think is wrong on a number of both policy and, frankly, moral levels. And then, of course, there are some pharmacologic therapies that can improve cognitive abilities and manage some of the common emotional problems that patients have, particularly anxiety and depression. And so those are out there. They're available. But I think the novel therapies that are just beginning, I think, to enter the clinic, I suspect by 2023, certainly 2024, we'll start prescribing them, are these therapies that we think are slowing the progression of the disease so that it takes longer before you develop further disability absent treatment.
One of the primary thrusts of your book is of some serious missteps that have occurred kind of in the whole realm of research, particularly when we get into this matter of accelerated approval, where certain treatments have been sort of quick listed, or I forget what the term is, but I mean where the process of approval has been fast-tracked, and then suddenly we have a medication that we clearly don't understand, or that is causing unanticipated side effects or whatever it might be. So first of all, I think you do a really good job of kind of painting the picture of why such a thing happens for understandable reasons, and some of the reasons for this actually stem back to the days of when we were first contending with HIV and fast-tracking some of the treatments for that, and we are living with kind of the consequences of that.
Yeah, so this is a good pitch for folks to pre-order the paperback of the book, because which comes out November 1. Sorry, it's a shameless plug, but in the paperback, which will be out in less than a month now, I added an afterword called "A Force More Powerful Than the FDA." That's the title of the afterword, and that title comes from a direct quote from Janet Woodcock, the acting commissioner of the FDA at the time. So, what I narrate there is what I think some would say: well, it's just a quirky story of a bad set of events. But I actually think there's a lot to learn from the approval in June of 2021. FDA's approval of Biogen's drug aducanumab for the treatment of Alzheimer's. And what FDA did was use a set of regulations that I would call conditional approval. Namely, they allowed the drug, Biogen, to market and sell the drug, not on the basis of Biogen being able to show that the drug slowed the progression of the disease. Patients' cognition and function didn't get didn't decline as fast on drug compared to placebo. They allowed the drug to be sold and marketed by Biogen solely on the basis of the fact that the drug lowered amyloid, the so-called surrogate marker. And I chronicle in the book, you know, the events that led up to that decision, and some of them are very particular, unique, and, you know, odd to the weird relationship that began to develop between Biogen and the FDA officials. But there are larger stories there, and that's why I devoted the afterword to it, around stories of desperation and also the increasing view that FDA's job is to foster innovation in the marketplace. Hence that title, "There's a Force More Powerful Than the FDA," which the remainder of that quote is Janet Woodcock saying, and it's the marketplace. And you know, what Woodcock's point is that the marketplace, in the end, decides what should be our treatments. And I mean, I understand why she says that, but as I point out in the chapter, it's that kind of political view, and it is a political view, that I think led us to a decision that was just just wrong. And in fact, you know, Biogen essentially has ceased commercial production of aducanumab. And I think for all intents and purposes, the drug probably will fade away because there are other drugs that have finished up well-designed clinical trials that have clinical data as well as biomarker data, one of them being lecanemab, which I mentioned earlier, which 2 weeks ago the press release announced the results of what sounds like a positive study, although, of course, we need to see the results beyond just a press release.
Right. You point out that, and I think you just touched on this, that there was a little bit too cozy a relationship between certain officials at the FDA and people at Biogen, and that people at the FDA were actually kind of almost coaching some of the people at Biogen on how they could make their way through the approval process. And that just that just doesn't smell right. You want there to be a certain kind of official objective distance between those seeking approval and those who are granting it. And it seems like something not quite right had developed there. At one point, I think you say regulators need to be better gatekeepers.
Well, yeah, I think the key thing is that FDA needs to rethink what its role is. And I think FDA, I have to have respect, is caught in a bind. I mean, on the one hand, they're supposed to make sure medicines are safe and effective. But on the other hand, there are these regulations like conditional approval and emergency authorization that allow substantial relaxing of the standards for safety and effectiveness. And this is because Congress is handing FDA all these different sort of, you know, missions and charges. And I think a recasting of FDA's role is in order. And I think probably the recasting ought to be that FDA's job is the production of quality information, good information about a drug, safety and efficacy. And seen that way, you know, it doesn't mean you can work within regulations that take FDA in very different directions. And I think one of the problems with the decision to approve aducanumab was the quality of the information that FDA reviewed and produced was just subpar. I mean, they actually had to go and revise the drug's label a few weeks after the approval, which was just it was a forced error. It was embarrassing. You know, they wrote this drug's label, and then 4 weeks later, they reissued a new label to correct some of the language that was opaque and not clear. So I think the lessons here, it's a bad story. The aducanumab story is a disturbing story. I didn't enjoy writing it, but I felt I had to write it because I think it has a lot of broader sort of guidance and lessons going forward. So as I say, that chapter is in the paperback, which comes out on November 1st, actually.
Right. That comes out. And I think it was actually in your blog for the University of Pennsylvania that I actually read some of that information. That's maybe where you first read that.
I adapted, you know, much of what I've written about aducanumab. You know, bits and pieces were repurposed and kind of, you know, and those other writings informed that chapter.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the last quick question, are you confident that the FDA has learned the lessons that it needs to learn in terms of this recent debacle?
I don't know. I mean, they recently reviewed a drug for ALS, and, you know, I think they went about things a little bit more carefully in terms of how they worked with their advisory board, et cetera. But there was a moment when an FDA official got up and said, you know, if the company doesn't do the confirmatory trial, I'll pull the drug. And my point was that it shouldn't come down to these sort of grandstanding and posturing by FDA officials. I mean, the regs should be clear. We shouldn't have to have these statements made, you know, that I'll take care of this if it doesn't work out. You know, it's like, oh, okay, you know, Mr. FDA official, you know, you're on the ball there. I mean, it shouldn't rely on that level of personality. The other, I've recently witnessed it same with a frontal temporal dementia meeting, an FDA official stand up, a patient's wife was speaking, and the FDA official got up and said, you know, you are the reason why I am here. You are the reason why we do what we do. We're here to serve you. And I think it's well, why are you saying this? Would you say the opposite? You know, you're not the reason why I'm here, and, you know, I'm not here to serve you. Of course you're there to serve her. But I don't understand the point of that kind of public posturing to the wife of a patient, except to say, well, first of all, well, what about future patients who don't yet have the disease, but who your decisions will affect. So what he's effectively saying is, I'm not going to think about the needs of future patients, which of course can lead you to make decisions that are very hasty and quick, because I want to serve you now and not see the public health picture of future patients. It also begs the question of what's the right way to engage patients. I mean, of course patients should be listened to in the production of drugs. You know, I'm one too, that is to say I'm a caregiver. But I'd like it to be more than just, you know, you're going to stand up and listen to my story and say, your story is going to move me to make my decision. It's like, well, no, wait a minute. I could tell you different stories. Are they going to move you in a different direction? So I think they still need to tidy up the way they're working.
Right. It sounds like, as much as this needs to be about genuine compassion and concern for people whose lives are devastated by Alzheimer's or whatever we're talking about, this still, in terms of the approval process and regulation, still needs to be foremost about the science.
Well, it needs to be about the science and the service of society. And I think the way you do that is you establish policies and procedures informed by a position of reasonableness. And I think what many felt had happened with the aducanumab decision and some other FDA decisions is things seemed rather unreasonable. And I chronicle that in that chapter, you know, A Force More Powerful Than the FDA, how there were sort of surprises, like, that wasn't what we talked about. And I think when people are surprised, they sort of feel like their things are unreasonable. And so I think the sort of a restoration of reasonableness, I think, is in order, which arguably could be a good tagline for things in America in general, kind of a restoration of reasonableness.
I like the sounds of that. Dr. Karlowicz, I so appreciate, first of all, the important work that you've done on this incredibly important issue, and I appreciate you making time in your schedule to join me today on The Morning Show. I was honored to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Marvelous. My pleasure. Thanks a lot, Greg.
Dr. Jason Karlowicz is professor of medicine and medical ethics at the University of Pennsylvania and co-director of the Penn Memory Center. He is author of The Problem of Alzheimer's, How Science, Culture, and Politics Turned a Rare Disease into a Crisis and What We Can Do About It. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. Dr. Karlowicz will be delivering a presentation of the same name next Wednesday morning, October 12th, from 9 until 11, in the UW Parkside Student Center Cinema. And the public is invited to attend. The public can also attend the presentation virtually via Zoom. For more information about the event or to register for it, you're invited to visit uwp.edu/HHS. Again, uwp.edu/HHS. I wanted to mention several Morning Show interviews coming up next week that are also related to the topic of Alzheimer's. Beginning on Monday, when I will be replaying a conversation I recorded way back in 2003 with David Schenck, the author of a book called The Forgetting, Alzheimer's Portrait of an Epidemic, which inspired a PBS documentary of the same name. On Tuesday, journalist Mary Ellen Geist and her very touching memoir called Measure of the Heart, A Father's Alzheimer's, A Daughter's Return. And on Wednesday, the day of Dr. Karlowicz's presentation at UW Parkside, I will replay my memorable conversation with former Wisconsin Governor Marty Schreiber, talking about his book, My Two Elaines, Learning, Coping, and Surviving as an Alzheimer's Caregiver. The title refers to Governor Schreiber's beloved wife, Elaine, who succumbed to Alzheimer's and actually died from it earlier this year. And I also want to mention an upcoming theatrical presentation at Tremper High School on Saturday, October 15th. Two performances at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. of a very touching and also highly energetic play about Alzheimer's called Unforgettable. These two performances sponsored by the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center. Once again, we remind you that Dr. Jason Karlowish, my guest today on The Morning Show, speaks at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside next Wednesday morning, October 12th, from 9 until 11. And you can go to uwp.edu/HHS for more information. I'm Gregory Berg. And tomorrow on The Morning Show, concert pianist Joanne Polk, who is coming to perform a concert of music by women composers next Tuesday.